Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations 7 days a week in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on House of Bush, House of Saud, right after this message. Well, many of the lessons that you hear on the Law Hour are just a small part of my two-week school on courtroom strategy and procedure, and this class includes lessons ranging from what to do and what not to do at the arrest or when you receive a complaint, summons, or a citation. And you'll learn how to make a chronology of the names, dates, times, places, facts, witnesses, and evidence, just like the police do. And you'll learn how to conduct a hearing, present evidence, cross-examine witnesses, ask questions, make opening and closing statements, enter exhibits into evidence, and write motions, briefs, affidavits, and asseverations. And I don't just cover what goes on in the courtroom. You'll learn preliminary procedures, arraignments, bail setting, what papers to file, how to put exculpatory evidence into the record, how to present your legal and lawful positions, and what issues are appealable, and how to preserve those appealable issues for appellate review. Now, there are 28 essential elements to master in courtroom strategy and procedure, and you'll learn all of them here at the law school in this class. For more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, please call the law school at 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Now, Courtroom Strategy and Procedure is a school available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, just go to the website georgegordon.org, click onto the email. Send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. Well, back on September 11th, 2001, 19 Saudi citizens hijacked four airliners and crashed them into targets in the United States. All of the 9/11 participants were Saudis, not Palestinians or Iraqis or Jordanians. So what's the connection between 9/11 and Saudi Arabia? What's the connection between Saudi Arabia and George Bush? Well, while the United States was aiding Iraq throughout the 1980s, the CIA's campaign in Afghanistan was also well underway, becoming the biggest and most successful covert operation in the CIA agency's history. The entire program cost virtually no American casualties, and the entire war cost America less than $3 billion of taxpayer money. Yet it dealt a mortal blow to the Soviet Union, and it was deemed to be the major factor in winning the Cold War for the United States. The seeds of this campaign had been planted even before the Reagan-Bush administration took office through a bold but clandestine strategy designed by the Carter administration. Better known for his innocence and naivete than for audacious foreign policy ploys, President Carter nevertheless had a few tricks up his own sleeve. On July 3, 1979, on the advice of his brilliant and hawkish national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, President Carter signed the first directive to secretly aid the Afghan rebels known as the Mujahideen, who were fighting the pro-Soviet regime in Kabul. Soon, the CIA began to provide weapons and money to the Mujahideen through Islamic fundamentalist warriors. This was a war by proxy. The aid was intended to bait the Soviets into committing more troops and weapons to defending their newly embattled allies. If everything went according to plan, ultimately, the Soviets would take the bait and become ensnared in a brutal, expensive, futile, and endless war that would lead to the disintegration of their vast empire. On December 26, less than 5 months later, the USSR did in fact take the bait, and Soviet troops marched into Afghanistan to confront their emboldened foes. To Brzezinski, who was the architect of the plan, the Soviet invasion offered the United States an unrivaled geopolitical opportunity. As soon as the Soviets crossed the border, he wrote to President Carter, quote, "We now have the opportunity of giving to the USSR its Vietnam War," unquote. The policy was a delicious new rendering of the so-called Great Game, made famous in Rudyard Kipling's novel Kim, in which the British used indigenous Islamic forces to keep the Russians out of Afghanistan. But now the Americans were updating this plan for the Cold War. On the grand global chessboard, Brzezinski's strategy was a gambit worthy of Kasparov, and when the Reagan-Bush administration took office, they eagerly embraced it. Soon, aid to the Afghan rebels was a centerpiece of what the administration called the Reagan Doctrine. The intention of the policy was to make Soviet support for the Third World governments too costly to be sustainable. A student of the American Revolutionary War, CIA Director Bill Casey, said the key to the American victory in 1776 was that they used irregular partisan guerrilla warfare. That was the methodology of the Afghan Mujahideen, and Casey liked it, and he liked it early on. It was buoyed by reports that covert aid to the Mujahideen was paying off, and according to declassified CIA intelligence assessment reports in late 1982, the agency believed that the rugged terrain of Afghanistan and the resourcefulness of the Mujahideen would prevent the Soviets from winning. The report concluded that even an extra 50,000 Soviet troops would be unlikely to break the logjam. By this time, Prince Bandar had become King Fahd's trusted point man in Washington. So when Bill Casey approached Bandar about Saudi Arabia's funding of an escalation of anti-Soviet forces, the two men flew to Jeddah, with Bandar serving as Casey's translator for the meeting with King Fahd. Casey met a receptive audience. This campaign was uniquely appealing to the Saudis. Not only would it enable them to cement their ties to the United States, it would also help the royal family deal with domestic unrest. And so the House of Saud eagerly joined in matching America, dollar for dollar, supporting the Mujahideen, as Prince Turki, longtime head of Saudi intelligence, puts it. In the U.S. Congress, the Afghan rebels were championed by Democratic Congressman Charlie Wilson, the colorful 6-foot-7-inch skirt-chasing cocaine-snorting Texan whose role in America's biggest covert operation was celebrated in George Crile's book, Charlie Wilson's War. At dinner parties in Houston and in Washington, Wilson would bring together the likes of Henry Kissinger, White House Chief of Staff James Baker, and Prince Bandar, along with glittering assortments of senators, astronauts, diplomats, Texas oil barons, and military men in celebration of the Mujahideen. "Allah will not be pleased if the king abandons his freedom fighters," Wilson would tease Bandar, to which Bandar replied, "Allah will soon be smiling, Charlie, you'll see." For his part, Wilson played an important role in seeing to it that Congress provided the $3 billion in covert aid for the Afghan rebels. The Saudis were a key part of the equation. Thousands of young warriors, calling themselves Afghan Arabs, streamed out of Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Yemen, and all over the Middle East to aid the Mujahideen. in the same way that these same Muslims are flowing into Iraq to fight the Americans today. Neither the United States nor the Saudis seem to mind that the crusading young Muslims could not have cared less about helping America win the Cold War. These warriors were motivated by religious fervor and passion. This was a people's war, a noble crusade against an infidel superpower that had invaded Muslim lands to fight to avenge the martyrdom of their Afghan brothers being crushed by Moscow. It was a time to demonstrate faith and courage for many Muslim young men. The liberation of Afghanistan became a very personal jihad. In sharp contrast to the Mecca affair, the Afghanistan war was a mission that could be embraced by the gamut of Saudi society, from the wealthy merchant families and the House of Saud to the militant clerics and the fundamentalist masses. For the royal family, the war was not just part of the cornerstone of the burgeoning Saudi alliance with the United States, but it served other purposes as well. Contributing to the war effort placated the militant clerics, and it helped accommodate the growing unrest and the more radical elements of society. In the wake of the Iranian Revolution, there was a new determination on the part of Saudi Muslims to outdo their Iranian counterparts, to create a new Islamic man. Instead of focusing their anger at the House of Saud or the United States, these militants could now zero in on the atheistic Soviets, a missionary zeal spread through every layer of society, and there was a sense that every penny you sent made a difference, says Armand Habibi, an American lawyer who has practiced in Saudi Arabia for many years. It was a very noble movement. The poor gave away prayer rugs, embroidered tablecloths, and it established a monumental footprint that went across all levels of society. As the war got underway with the United States, the Saudis and the Pakistanis secretly supporting the Afghan rebels, the Pakistani Inter-Services Intelligence Agency hoped that Prince Turki bin Faisal, who was then head of Saudi intelligence and a member of the House of Saud, would bring an actual member of the royal family to the front to demonstrate the commitment of the House of Saud to the jihad. But there were no Saudi princes wanted to, nor were there any that needed to brave the Afghan mountains. Osama bin Laden, a protege of Prince Turki, was the next best thing. At 22 years old, Osama bin Laden could easily have become a wealthy Saudi businessman like his father, Mohammed, or his elder brother, Salim. Thanks to his family's vast fortune and close ties to the royal family, he was perfectly positioned to join the Saudi elite. Instead, incensed by the Soviet invasion, he went straight to Afghanistan. "I was enraged and I went there at once," he said. He arrived before the end of 1979, just a few days after Soviet troops had crossed the border. For Osama bin Laden, the war in Afghanistan was not only a historic turning point during which he would emerge as a leader, it was also a momentous time in Muslim history. He and his fellow Afghan Arabs were stirred by the plight of Muslims from a medieval society besieged by a 20th century superpower. "One day in Afghanistan," bin Laden said, "counted for more than 1,000 days praying in a mosque." Bin Laden's action carried extraordinary weight in large part because of his family's unique place in Saudi society. Their ties to the royal family were so crucial that both sides made certain that the relationships transcended generations. Many of the 25 bin Laden brothers attended school with the sons of King Abdul Aziz and his successor, King Faisal, at Victoria College in Alexandria, where they had classmates such as King Hussein of Jordan and Khashoggi brothers, of whom Adnan was the preeminent Saudi arms dealer of the Iran-Contra era, and Kamim Adam, the billionaire who ran Saudi intelligence before Prince Turki. The boys earned reputations as discreet chaperones for the young royals. In 1968, when Mohammed bin Laden was killed in a plane crash, King Faisal said his right arm had been broken, and he rushed to the support of the bin Laden family, who at that time did not have anyone old enough to take the helm of the family business. King Faisal appointed the highly regarded head of his own construction company to make sure that the bin Laden Saudi group was in good hands until Salim, Osama's older half-brother, was old enough to take over. Later, when King Fahd took the throne in 1982, Salim became one of his two best friends. Closely tied as they were to both the royal family and the United States, at this point, the bin Laden family had only indirect connections to the Bush family and its allies. James Bath, the American business representative of Salim bin Laden, knew both George W. Bush and George Bush Sr. Khalid bin Mufaz, who was close to both the bin Ladens and the royal family, had helped to finance the Houston skyscraper for the Texas Commerce Bank, in which James Baker had a significant interest. He also had close ties to Bath. Now, these Bush-Bin Laden relationships were indirect, 2 degrees of separation perhaps, and at times have been overstated. Critics have asserted that money may have gone from Khalid bin Mufaz and Salim bin Laden through James Bath into Arbusto Energy, the oil company started by George W. Bush. But no hard evidence has ever been found to back up that allegation. But more to the point now, in the Afghanistan war, Vice President Bush's interests and Osama bin Laden's converged. In using bin Laden's Arab Afghans as proxy warriors against the Soviets, Bush advocated a policy that was fully in line with American interests at that time. And he did not consider the long-term implications of supporting a network of Islamic fundamentalist rebels and terrorists. Specifically, as vice president in the mid-1980s, George Bush supported aiding the Mujahideen in Afghanistan through the Maktab al-Kamit, or services offices, which sent money and fighters to the Afghan resistance in Peshawar. Bush was in charge of the covert operations that supported the MAK, says John Loftus. He was a Justice Department official in the 1980s, and they were essentially hiring a terrorist to fight terrorism. Co-founded by Osama bin Laden and Abdullah Azim, the MAK was the precursor to bin Laden's global terrorist network, now known as Al-Qaeda. It sent money and fighters to the Afghan resistance in Peshawar, and it set up recruitment centers in over 50 countries, including Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, and even the United States, to bring thousands of warriors to Afghanistan to fight the Soviet Union. The MAK was later linked to the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center in New York City through an office in Brooklyn known as the Al-Kafi Refuge Center. It's not clear how much contact he had with bin Laden, but Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman, the blind sheikh who masterminded the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center, also appeared in Peshawar on occasion. Throughout the 80s in Saudi Arabia, Prince Turki oversaw bin Laden's efforts aiding the Mujahideen. Prince Bandar also met bin Laden, but many years later said that he was not impressed with the young man. He said at the time, "I thought he couldn't lead 8 ducks across the street," Bandar said. And yet Osama now played a vital role for the House of Saud, not merely a trophy to show how committed the royal family was to this noble cause. He helped the House of Saud celebrate the American commitment to the Mujahideen's efforts. Osama bin Laden used to come to us when America was helping our brother Mujahideen in Afghanistan to get rid of the communist, secularist Soviet Union forces, recalled Prince Bandar. Osama bin Laden came and said, "Thank you. Thank you for bringing the Americans to help us to get rid of the secularist, atheist, communist Soviets." Between 1980 and 1982, Osama bin Laden went back and forth repeatedly between Saudi Arabia and the front in Afghanistan, bringing donations from the Saudis. In Jeddah, his family enthusiastically endorsed his commitment to this cause, working closely with Prince Turki and Prince Salman, the governor of Riyadh, and bin Laden played a key role in financing, recruiting, and training Arabian volunteers. Finally, in 1982, Osama settled in Peshawar and the command headquarters of the Jihad near the Khyber Pass, known as the Dodge City of the Afghan Rebels, bringing with him engineers and heavy construction equipment from the Saudi bin Laden Company to build roads and depots for the Mujahideen, and in those years there was no Al-Qaeda, says Prince Turki. Bin Laden gave money, equipment, and construction material from his family's personal funds and from the company. Abdullah Azim, the professor cleric Mujahid who had taught at the university in Jeddah when Osama was there, had by this time become a spiritual leader of the Mujahideen. Azim was the man who developed the idea of jihad in a complete way, said Mukahil, a professor of the Islamic Center for Peshawar University. Azim enshrines the need for armed struggle as a part of daily life, and Azim helped many Arabs just off the plane take part in the jihad by starting the Jihad Training University. With Azim as his mentor, Osama bin Laden began recruiting warriors for the jihad. Osama would have been nothing without Azim, and with, said one expert on the Taliban. Before he came to Peshawar, Osama was a kind of playboy, a dilettante, not serious, not anything like we see today. Some Western publications have characterized bin Laden as merely having used his family fortune to bankroll the Mujahideen. Given his wealth, it was tempting for critics to dismiss him as a Gucci terrorist. But according to a Pakistani who fought alongside him, he was a hero to us because he was always on the front lines, always moved ahead of everyone else. He not only gave of his money, he gave of himself. He was indeed a leader. All of which served U.S. interests at the time, and in a way the CIA had only dreamed of. In 1985, a CIA assessment estimated that there had already been 92,000 combined Soviet and Afghan casualties, more than twice that of the rebels, and that the Soviets were no closer than they were in 1979 to achieving their goals in Afghanistan. The report concluded that the Soviets were unlikely to quell the rebels' insurgency. To CIA Chief Bill Casey, the success was inspiring, a longtime Cold War warrior who believed not in containment, but what in the late 40s and early 50s had been called rollback. Casey saw that he could push all the way across the Soviet border by escalating the war in Afghanistan. Casey had told John McMahon, the CIA's deputy director of operations, how he felt about Afghanistan. "This is the kind of thing that we should be doing, and only more of it. I want to see one place in the world, one spot where we can checkmate the communists and then roll them back. We've got to make the communists feel the heat. Otherwise, we'll never get them to the negotiating table." And so it was. The United States escalated the war. By 1987, well into the second term of the Reagan-Bush administration, the United States began to provide the rebels with nearly $700 million in military assistance a year. In addition, the CIA began supplying the Mujahideen with intelligence, training, and equipment that allowed them to make scattered strikes against factories, military installations, and storage depots that were actually inside the Soviet Union. They gave the Islamic rebels satellite reconnaissance data, intercepted Soviet intelligence, and they provided sniper rifles, timing devices, tons of C4 explosives for urban sabotage, anti-tank missiles, and other sophisticated equipment. Most coveted of all were the Stinger missiles, portable, shoulder-fired anti-aircraft guided missiles with infrared seekers for downing low-flying helicopters and airplanes. Missiles that were so sophisticated that, as one CIA officer put it, a near-sighted, illiterate Afghan could bring down $1 million worth of Soviet aircraft with one shot. With a hit rate of 89%, the Stingers downed an average of one plane every day. Soon the Afghan Air Force was depleted, and for the Soviets, the cost of the war escalated. Meanwhile, Osama bin Laden built a major arms storage depot, training facilities, and medical centers for the Mujahideen. He did this at cost in eastern Afghanistan. Peshawar became the center of a burgeoning pan-Islamic movement. More than 25,000 Islamic guerrillas from the Palestinians, Hamas, from Egypt's Al-Gamas, and Al-Jihad from Algeria's Islamic Salvation Front. They came from the Philippines, the Moral Liberation Front, from countries all over the world, including the United States, made the pilgrimage through Peshawar to Afghanistan in the jihad. You can sit at the Khyber Pass and see every color, every creed, every nationality pass, a Western diplomat reported. These groups, in their wildest imagination, never would have met if there had been no jihad. For a Moro to get a Stinger missile to make contacts with Islamists from North Africa, the United States created a Moscow Central in Peshawar for these groups, and the consequences for all of us today are astronomical. A new network of charities grew into a formidable infrastructure to support the growing pan-Islamic movement. Money flowed into the services offices in Peshawar. A new leadership emerged that included Sheikh Azam and his best friend, the rotund blind Sheikh Omar from Egypt. CIA forces in Peshawar saw him as a valuable asset, letting pass his militant anti-Western sentiments because he was such a powerful force in uniting the Mujahideen. Bin Laden became a leader. His identity was truly forged in this period. If you really want to understand Osama bin Laden, you have to understand Afghanistan in the 1980s, said his younger brother, who last saw Osama at the funeral of their brother Salim in 1988. His views do not come from his childhood or from his upbringing. Osama bin Laden's views come from prolonged exposure to war against a non-Islamic force, the communists. Look to that period of history for your answers, he said, and in the West, people do not understand the incensing brutality of the Soviet war in Afghanistan. It had a severe effect on bin Laden, and it seemed to change him completely. I believe it fomented his radical feelings, and it scarred him. At least, this is how I try to understand my brother and come to terms with what he has done. Arab journalists who covered him then spoke of him in dark romantic terms. He's a man that seeks the afterlife and who truly feels that he has lived more than enough. You feel there's a sadness in him, which he did not express, that he was not martyred when he was fighting the Soviet army. You feel like he's saying, why did I survive? Why am I still alive? All right, we're talking about Osama bin Laden, the House of Bush, and House of Saud. We'll have to take a break right here. We'll be back in a few minutes, so don't go away. I'll be right back. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, many of the lessons that you hear on The Law Hour are just a small part of my two-week school on courtroom strategy and procedure, and this school includes lessons ranging from what to do and what not to do at the arrest or when you receive a complaint, summons, or citation. And you'll learn how to make a chronology of the names, dates, times, places, facts, witnesses, and evidence, just like the police do. And you'll learn how to conduct a hearing, present evidence, cross-examine witnesses, ask questions, make opening and closing statements, and enter exhibits into evidence, write motions, briefs, affidavits, and asseverations. And I don't just cover what goes on in the courtroom. You'll learn preliminary procedures, arraignments, bail setting, what papers to file, how to put exculpatory evidence into the record, and how to present your legal and lawful positions. What issues are appealable? How do you preserve those appealable issues for appellate review? Now, there are 28 essential elements to master in courtroom strategy and procedure, and you'll learn all of them here at the law school in this class. Now, for more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, just call the law school at 417-273-4967. Now, be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. That's a 4-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. Remember, it's entertaining, educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. That number again, 417-273-4967. Be sure to order yours today. Courtroom strategy and procedures available on compact disc for adult home education. And if you're online, you can go to the website georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send me an email request for that free general law CD package. georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about Craig Unger's blockbuster book, House of Bush, House of Sod. I rated a 1 in 100 read. You can order a copy from Scriber, S-C-R-I-B-N-E-R and Company. Copyrighted 2004. It's a brand new book, $26 U.S., $39 Canadian. ISBN number is 7432-5337-X. Again, that's ISBN 0-7432-5337-X. I recommend that you buy a copy. I can't cover a tenth of the information contained in this expose. You'll have to read it for yourself. But I'm going to give you an education in American Saudi geopolitics, I'll guarantee you that. Now listen to some more of the story. In February of 1987, a CIA assessment reported that the war in Afghanistan was crippling the Soviet Union. General Secretary Gorbachev was referred, or has referred, to the war as a bleeding wound. The report read, it had led to censure of the Soviets within the UN, impinged on Soviet relations with China and non-aligned third world nations, caused domestic social unrest, and diverted energies from pressing economic problems in Russia. But the report did not say, but the Soviets felt, was that tens of thousands of Soviet youths were dying on killing fields in a forgotten and foreign land, fighting for a cause they didn't believe in, detested by the local population, they allegedly fought for, bleeding the crippling economy of their own country dry. Now for the Americans, the Afghanistan policy was so successful that as the 1988 presidential election neared, George Bush saw it as proof of his bona fides as a Cold War warrior during his campaign against Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis. On October the 18th, 1988, Bush stopped at Westminster College in Fulton, Missouri, the site of Winston Churchill's 1946 historic speech warning that an iron curtain of communism was descending across the European continent. Bush seized the propitious occasion to comment on what Reagan had famously labeled the evil empire. It was George Bush's most dramatic speech of the campaign, perhaps of his entire life, and it commemorated what was unquestionably the greatest accomplishment of the Reagan-Bush era, the end of the Cold War. The Iron Curtain still stretches from Stettin to Trieste, Bush said, but it's a rusting curtain. Shafts of light from the western side, from our side, the free and prosperous side, are piercing the gloom of failure and despair on the other side of the Iron Curtain. The truth is being sought as never before, he added, and the people of Eastern Europe, the peoples of the Soviet Union itself, are demanding more freedom, demanding their place in the sun. 70 years after the Russian Revolution, Bush said, Marxism is finally losing its luster. At last, in the age of Mikhail Gorbachev's glasnost and perestroika, the Cold War was thawing and there was a sense of a new flexibility. One key reason for such historic changes, Bush said, was that the price of aggression was too high because we supported the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. Well, by the time George Bush moved into the White House, in January of 1989, having easily beaten Dukakis, the Soviet troops were already withdrawing from Afghanistan. At CIA headquarters, William Webster, who had succeeded Bill Casey as director, and his euphoric Afghan team toasted the success of the multi-billion dollar covert operation to support the Muslim Afghan rebels. The Cold War was over. The Afghan campaign had been the coup de grace. And as the Soviets withdrew, the many unintended consequences of that war in Afghanistan began to become increasingly apparent. The arms pipeline set up by the CIA had unwittingly become a drug pipeline as well. As first reported by the Herald, an English-language magazine in Pakistan, the main conduit through which weapons reached the Afghan rebels was now one of the principal routes for the transport of heroin to Karachi for shipment to Europe and the United States. It's really very simple, the Herald reported in January of 1987. If you control the poppy fields, Karachi, and the road which links the two, you'll be so rich that you'll control Pakistan. The article added that the drugs came down by truck from Peshawar with sacks containing packets of heroin. This has been going on now for about 3.5 years. An even bigger issue, however, was that the United States was still pouring billions of dollars in funding and sophisticated weaponry to build a vast pan-Islamist army. And during the Afghan War, if there was any thought of post-war complications from this stuff, it wasn't much expressed, says Frank Anderson. He was the chief of the CIA's Afghan task force from 1987 to 1989. Everyone was busy getting the Soviets kicked out of Afghanistan. The Muslim world was excited by this stuff, and at the time, we knew nothing of these activities being related to terrorism. We set up the very system of Islamic terrorism that we are now trying to dismantle in Iraq, says a senior investigator who participated in the Senate probe into BCCI. People seem to forget that we invented this, that Bill Casey was getting the Saudi fundamentalists to assemble all these kooks and to go out and kill the Russians. No one ever asked what would happen when it was all over. Throughout the 80s, most of the American media, with a few rare exceptions, such as Edward Gardaray of the Christian Science Monitor, simply ignored the war in Afghanistan. And yet, as Steve Gallister, project director of the National Security Archives, Afghanistan Archives, has observed, this was the longest war in the Soviet Union's history, the longest CIA paramilitary operation since Vietnam, and with 1 million dead Afghans, it was the bloodiest regional conflict in the world at that time. Even America's most heralded investigative reporters missed the story. In a book called Veil, his 1987 account of the CIA secret wars of that era Bob Woodward devotes several pages to the Afghanistan operation, but he does not mention the Mujahideen, Wahhabism, BCCI, or in any way suggest that billions of American dollars were going to arm and finance a global network of militant Islamic fundamentalist terrorists. On rare occasions, starting as early as 1983, these concerns did make their way up the policy ladder in Washington. That year, the CIA suspected that the Mujahideen had gotten so many weapons that they were selling the extras to third parties. So they sent CIA Deputy Director of Operations John McMahon out to investigate. Well, when he got to Peshawar, McMahon brought together eight different Mujahideen from eight different tribes who ran the supply operation and confronted them. "Finally, I brought up our main concern," said McMahon. "We'd given them enough landmines to mine the whole damn country. So I just laid it out. I said, we have a feeling that all the weapons that you're giving, that we're giving you, aren't showing up on the battlefield. What's going on? Are you cashing them in?" One tribal chief named Kali gave McMahon an unexpectedly candid response. "Yes, we are. We do sell some of your weapons. We are doing it for the day when your country decides to abandon us. Just as you abandoned Vietnam, and just as you abandon everyone else that you deal with." Now, for all of that, Washington actually responded by sending more and more sophisticated weapons to Afghanistan. By 1986, the Reagan administration was supplying hundreds of the sought-after Stinger missiles to the Mujahideen. The two premises behind the decision were, one, that the transactions would remain secret, and two, that the Islamic rebels would not use them for terrorist activities. Soon enough, however, Reagan's decision was widely reported in the news, and one Republican aide on Capitol Hill pointed out the risks of arming the Mujahideen. He said, "Some of these guys are a lot closer politically, religiously, and philosophically to Iran's Ayatollah Khomeini than they are to us," the aide said. "There is concern that one of these guys could show up in Rome aiming a Stinger missile at a jumbo jet." Nor was that the only sign that the groundwork was being laid for a national security catastrophe. In Saudi Arabia, I was repeatedly ordered by high-level State Department officials to issue visas to unqualified applicants. Michael Springman, the head of the American Visa Bureau in Jeddah from 1987 to 89, told the BBC. He said that people who had no ties either to Saudi Arabia or to their own country. "And I complained there. I complained here in Washington to Maine State, to the Inspector General, and to diplomatic security, and I was totally ignored. What I was doing was giving visas to terrorists recruited by the CIA and Osama bin Laden to come back to the United States for training to be used in the war in Afghanistan against the Soviet Union." That was blowback. Afghanistan provided a place where these guys could hang out in a subculture for people who wanted to be warriors, says the FBI's Frank Anderson. "It built up the craft of giving money to people like this that undoubtedly continued past when it should have." Well, by the late 1980s, the CIA finally approached the Saudis about whether the Muslims' enthusiasm for the battle was getting out of hand. The Saudis said, "Well, we can't modulate this," recalls Anderson. They said, "We can either turn the flow of money on or the flow of money off." Well, by February of 1989, the last Soviet soldier had left Afghanistan, but the pro-Soviet government continued to hold power in Kabul. On February 12th, President Bush approved continuing U.S. military aid to the rebels resisting the Soviet-imposed government in Afghanistan, with the prospect that the puppet government would soon fall. The United States was exuberant. At last, America had now learned how to achieve its foreign policy goals without incurring massive casualties or massive costs. It was an extraordinary bipartisan achievement. Even a decade later, one of the principal architects of the policy, Zbigniew Brzezinski, evinced very few regrets. "What is most important to the history of the world?" he asked the French weekly. "The Taliban or the collapse of the Soviet Empire? Some stirred up Muslims or the liberation of Central Europe and the end of the Cold War?" Brzezinski and the Reagan-Bush administration were right about the extraordinary value of supporting the Mujahideen, but they had resolved the past by endangering the future. They vastly underestimated the price that America would pay in the long run. And thanks to the United States, Osama bin Laden had learned an important lesson. Mujahideen warriors fighting for Islam could bring a superpower to its knees. And if they could bring one superpower to its knees, they felt that they could bring the other superpower to its knees. Not long after he took office in 1989, President Bush was warned about exactly this possibility by someone in a position to know. Displeased that the president continued to support extremist radical Muslims, Pakistani Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto let him know about the dangers. He said arming the Mujahideen might initially have been the right thing to do, she told Bush, but she explained the extremists are now so emboldened by the United States. During the 1980s, they are now exporting their terrorism to other parts of the world to such an extent that they use heroin trafficking to pay for their exploits. It had now gone too far, she said. By aligning the United States with the most extremist Mujahideen group, she told them, you are creating a veritable Frankenstein monster. Now, by this time, Bhutto's Frankenstein had set up a vast infrastructure capable of financing a global operation for years to come. It was now known as Al-Qaeda. Osama bin Laden was now seen as a heroic figure in the Afghanistan war, and money poured into his operations from the mosques, from the House of Saud in Saudi Arabia, Saudi intelligence, the Saudi Red Crescent, the equivalent to the American Red Cross, the World Muslim League, various princes, and the kingdom's merchant elite from all over Saudi Arabia. Perhaps the greatest insight into the origins of Al-Qaeda came after a March 19, 2003 raid by Bosnian authorities on the Sarajevo offices of the Benevolence International Foundation. That's a multi-million dollar Islamic charity, and it yielded a computer with a file marked Tariq Osama, Arabic for Osama's history. The contents included the key founding documents of Al-Qaeda, including photographs and scanned letters, some in Osama bin Laden's own handwriting. One 1988 document tells about how Al-Qaeda evolved from the Afghan resistance and how we took very huge gains from the country's people in Saudi Arabia, gathering donations in very large amounts. One document asserted, the only solution is the continuation of the armed jihad. Notes discussed training with Kalashnikov rifles and showed how the group began to take the battle that had begun in Afghanistan onto Chechnya, Bosnia, the Sudan, Eritrea. An extraordinary network of global terrorism was now taking shape with Osama bin Laden at the helm. Probably the most noteworthy item discovered had a verse from the Quran, and spend for God's cause, followed by a list of 20 wealthy Saudi donors known as the Golden Chain. And after each name, the translator had written a second name in parentheses. which according to U.S. News and World Report suggested who was the recipient of the money from that particular donor. And one of the names, Osama bin Laden, appeared 7 times. The donors of the Golden Chain were not just wealthy Saudis. They were the creme de la creme of the great Saudi industrial and merchant elite, including the royal family. Among them, they owned 16 of the 100 biggest Saudi companies, which had more than $85 billion in assets in 2003. There were 3 billionaire bankers, a former governor, minister, and leading Saudi merchants and industrialists, including, not surprisingly, the bin Laden brothers, who ran the Saudi bin Laden group. Banking moguls Khalid bin Mufaz and Salah Kamil were on the list, as were the Al-Raji banking family. Bin Mufaz, who contributed $250,000, was one of the 7 donors on the list who had Osama bin Laden's name next to his. Now, by this time, bin Mufaz had taken over the National Commerce Bank from his father and effectively became the banker for the royal family, the House of Saud, and the most powerful banker in Saudi Arabia. As a result, over the next decade, his name was on many, many wire transfers to Muslim charities that sent funds to Al-Qaeda. He was the banker for the royal family, says Robert Baer, a former CIA case officer in the Middle East and the author of Sleeping with the Devil. Now, if someone in the royal family ordered money to be transferred, he would have no choice. That's the way the relationship works. Now, in addition, by then, bin Mufaz had also become the biggest investor in BCCI. Not only did the bank, BCCI, finance arms deals in both the Afghanistan war and in the Iran-Iraq war, it also continued to pursue U.S. political contacts. Just as it had lured Burt Lance and Clark Clifford a decade earlier. In 1987, one company in particular that interested BCCI investors was a troubled Texas oil company called Harkin Energy. Harkin Energy, owned by George W. Bush, loaded with debt, having drilled dry hole after dry hole, beset by accounting irregularities, barely subsisting during a period in which the price of oil was plummeting. Harkin seemed like a particularly unlikely investment for the Saudis, especially in light of Saudi Arabia's vast oil riches. Nevertheless, Harkin Energy had one asset that BCCI truly knew how to appreciate. One of its investors and directors was a 41-year-old businessman and son of the former president, George W. Bush, known as W. George W. Bush Jr. Now, breezily, likable, seemingly uncomplicated, George W. Bush once said that the difference between him and his father was that his dad attended Greenwich Country Day and I went to San Jacinto High School in Midland, Texas. He was right. W., as he was known in Texas, shared much of his father's legacy. Andover, Yale, Skull and Bones, Texas, and the oil business, and a close association with the Saudis. Now, given that James Baker and George Herbert Walker Bush later compared Saddam Hussein to Adolf Hitler, why did they support the Iraqi dictator for more than 7 years after they first learned of his atrocities? In his 1995 memoirs, The Politics of Diplomacy, a somewhat chagrined James Baker looks back on his years as Secretary of State, and he attempts to explain his role in forging this manifest policy toward such a brutal monster. The strongest argument Baker makes is that initially the United States needed Saddam's Iraq to contain the emerging threat of Iran's Islamic fundamentalism. And Baker also asserts, less persuasively, that Iraq was a potentially helpful Arab ally in the Middle East and in the peace process. Even less convincingly, Baker argues that giving Saddam Hussein incentives might stem nuclear proliferation, bring economic benefits, and enhance prospects for Arab-Israeli peace. And then finally, Baker cites banal domestic, economic, and political considerations. The Department of Agriculture loan guarantees to Iraq, he says, were extremely popular with American agricultural interests. And if the Bush administration had not supported these programs, Baker adds, we would surely have been castigated by Democratic congressmen. So by the late 1980s, however, neoconservative Republican policymakers such as Richard Perle and Paul Wolfowitz had begun voicing their discontent with the Bush administration's pro-Saddam policies. A militant hawk, sometimes referred to by critics as the Prince of Darkness. Richard Perle was a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, later chaired the Defense Policy Board, and was often a supporter of policies endorsed by the Likud, Israel's largest right-wing political party. Richard Perle is a Jew. And even during the Iran-Iraq War, Perle had been uncomfortable with supporting Saddam Hussein and felt that the right course immediately after the end of that war would have been to say to Saddam, now we've had enough of you too, and we're not going to tolerate it. So by the spring of 1990, Saddam Hussein's love affair with the White House had survived 10 years of the Reagan-Bush era, but thanks to Saddam's overreaching, Richard Perle was about to get his wish. And as a rule in the Arab world, it didn't hurt to lash out at Israel. But on April the 2nd, Saddam made the kind of slip of the tongue of which diplomatic catastrophes are born, boasting that he had chemical weapons and would use them to make fire eat up half of Israel. James Baker, State Department, immediately issued a statement saying that the remarks were inflammatory, irresponsible, and outrageous. Saddam was so stunned by the angry reaction from Washington that he promptly got on the phone to King Fahd of Saudi Arabia and demanded that Fahd send someone to Iraq immediately to act as a go-between between the United States. Well, the best man for that job was Fahd's nephew, Prince Bandar. Ah, the webs we weave. Well, we're going to have to leave it right there. We'll be back tomorrow night, same time, same station, with more on this story of the Bush and Saudi relationship and how that Bush family and Saudi family, the House of Saud relationship, has affected international geopolitics and eventually the war in Iraq today. All right, the opinions, beliefs, the comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of the network or of this radio station. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and the editorial review, please go to my website, that's georgegordon.org, or call the law school direct at 417-273-4967. All right, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement only. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the law school. That number again, 417-273-4967. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, there's a signal says my time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here again tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.